Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's program is the sixth in the series on social entrepreneurship in America. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club and the moderator for tonight's program. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Bill Drayton. After attending Harvard, Oxford, and Yale, being the assistant administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency and a McKinsey consultant, Bill thought he needed a new challenge. He found that by creating an organization devoted to finding and fostering social entrepreneurs around the world, Bill was one of the first to recognize that by supporting the individual who creates new and innovative ways to address social needs, an extraordinary multiplier effect begins to take place. So in 1981, he created Ashoka, Innovators for the Public. Since that time, Ashoka has found and supported more than 2,700 amazing social entrepreneurs around the world, improving the lives of millions of people. Additionally, I personally have Bill to thank, as my husband was working with him at Ashoka in 1987 when we met at an Ashoka event. So on behalf of the millions around the world whose lives you have touched, thank you, Bill, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
So I want to make a request. Everyone, please stretch your imaginations, because we're going to go on a quite fast trip. You're going to need those imaginations. But this is not a trip to an imaginary place. This is a trip to our futures, which is coming very, very fast. It's going to change what all of us do, the skills we need, whatever institution you're a part of. It has to be managed and led and organized differently. Now, so that's the main thing I hope to do, but Ruth has told me that I must tell you a little bit about Ashoka and the learning process we've been through. And I resisted, but I eventually thought that this would actually be helpful to understand the larger picture. So start by imagining a 19-year-old young American in India. And that person was not made by God for football, and thought that Latin and math was a torture that had no purpose, but rather like starting things, was affected by the civil rights movement. And there he is in India, and ideas become realities, and statistics, people, and friends. And there's a 100-to-1 difference in average per capita income between America and India at that point. And what would you do? So that was the question. And that's where Ashoka comes from. Now, sophomores control very little. And so we're looking for a highly leveraged approach. And so now here you have to start working. What is the most powerful force in the world? It's pretty clear it's a big idea, pattern change idea, but only if it's in the hands of an entrepreneur. It's that combination that moves the world. And so we said, well, what if we could help more entrepreneurs dealing with these problems get started and succeed and come together in a powerful community? And it turns out that that is an extraordinarily good investment. There's a moment in the life cycle of the social entrepreneur when they know what the next step is. They don't know exactly how they're going to get there, and they've got to prototype it and develop it, and it'll take years. But they know. But who are they? What is this idea? The more important the idea, the less it fits the existing structures. And if you can intervene at that moment and help that person have the freedom to fly, to work with their idea, a very little investment can have a very big impact. And then you build a community of those people, and that becomes far more important. So that's the core Ashoka idea, and it started in India a long time ago. We now have actually just short of 3,000 leading social entrepreneurs in this community, virtually everywhere in the world. There are a few places where we can't elect fellows like Burma, but fellows from other parts of the world work in Burma or Belarus. So there are very few places we don't touch. The impact of those fellows, we do an evaluation every year. Over half have changed national policy within 5 years, and over three-quarters have changed the pattern in their field at the national level within 5 years. So this is a very, very powerful group of people who have a very strong sense of where the world is going. Now, in addition to helping build those key people and ideas, we've always been focused on building the field, the institutions of the field. So we've helped over 300 groups join in this effort around the world. Some of them you know very well, Avena, Echoing Green, Skoll, Schwab, New Profit, hundreds of others. And I think that's one of the most important things. We now have a field. When we got started, there wasn't even a word. We had to invent one. And people at that point would look glassy-eyed when you said social entrepreneur, and the smart ones would say it was an oxymoron, which was very annoying. We've learned over time that there actually is something more important, more powerful than an entrepreneur or an idea, and that's the community, and that's Ashoka 2.0. And in the last couple of years, we've realized something much more powerful, and that's collaborative entrepreneurship. This has never been done before in the world. It's hundreds of the world's best entrepreneurs from every continent working together to tip the world once we've figured out together where the world has to go. Now, I'm going to come back to that, but those are the three levels of learning, and it's been a growing process. So, obviously, the social entrepreneurs are key. Why? The central fact is that the rate of change is escalating exponentially. That's mathematically true. The same is true for the number of people causing change, and even more for the combinations and the richness of the combination of people's causing change. That is the central force going on in the world. That is defining the environment, the strategic environment that every one of us faces. And because that curve is exponential, it's going to be much more that way 2 years from now and much, much, much more that way in 5 years. So we are really at a point of transition that is as important as the agricultural revolution, except it won't take 3,000 years. It's much faster. And we've always been able to assume that the systems are sort of stable, at least in terms of the reference of a human life. You can't do that anymore. Now, what is the role of the entrepreneur? The entrepreneur's role is to change the system. Not applications, not a new clinic, a new school, a new department store, but change the system. And in the world we're going into, we need a class of entrepreneurs who are in it for the good of all. Many entrepreneurs are very usefully serving their shareholders or trying to advance the interest of one point of view. But the social entrepreneur, and this is really what defines the social entrepreneur, these are entrepreneurs who very deeply are committed to the good of all. And think ahead 5 or 10 years, the systems are not steady, and there's no resting place. They keep changing. We need this group of people who are working on changing the systems to serve everybody. What other force is going to be able to do that? How can we make them as powerful and effective as possible? So this is why the social entrepreneurs are so critical. Now, we've talked concept. I want to introduce you to a few social entrepreneurs. But again, you've got to work here a bit. As I do, try and figure out what are the common elements. What makes a really great social entrepreneur. So, this isn't working. All right, so let me introduce the first one, Mary Gordon, who is a Canadian. She grew up in Newfoundland and sounds like a Caledonian Mary Poppins. She saw something in her class. Kids were coming more and more who could only respond with aggression when another child made them uncomfortable. Of course, that invites aggression back, and you get the cycles, and every time you go through that cycle, it gets deeper. And she said, this is a bigger problem than my teaching of the class. And she gave herself permission to change the whole system. Now, I'm jumping ahead. 4 years later, there are 2,000 schools in Canada that have adopted her new approach. Bullying rates come down and stay down after this intervention. She's now in 5 other countries, including in Seattle, and some of you have actually helped her come here to San Francisco. What does she do? She asks for a couple of hours a month from the schools, that's all, for a year. And she brings an infant at the beginning of the year, less than 1 year old, who wears a little T-shirt, the professor. And students, not the teacher, sit and try and figure out what is the professor saying? And then what is the professor feeling? And they're watching the parent and the child, and they're seeing empathy, and they grasp empathy through a limbic learning process. Now, this is profoundly, profoundly important. Any child today, anywhere in the world, who does not master a highly sophisticated level of empathy will be marginalized. As you move up that curve of change, the rules cover less and less. They're always changing. They're in conflict. They haven't been invented yet. You can't be a good person just by following the rules. You need this skill of empathy. Now, how many elementary school principals in San Francisco, or for that matter anywhere in the world, know that they're failing if they've got one second grader who's not grasped empathy? It isn't even in the discussion. That's something that Mary and hundreds of other fellows around the world are changing. Now, here is another Ashoka fellow from San Francisco, Joe Violette, and she set to work to restore recess because she believes in play, partly because when she was 11, someone allowed her to play boys' games on the playground. Now, what she does is introduce group play so recess no longer leads to conflict and becomes highly educative. Principals want it. Well, what is group play? That's how kids learn how to play together. That's group. That's mastering empathy. Now, there are hundreds of stories like this. They fit together. Eric Dawson in Boston does the same thing in the classroom. In Molly Barker in Charlotte focuses on 5th to 8th grade girls who suffer a loss of confidence, and you have the mean girl syndrome as a symptom of that. We have got to work together to change that so that every child masters empathy and will not be marginalized. That's the foundation for going on to empathy, teamwork, leadership, change-making, which is what you have to master if you're going to be a real contributor to society. The organizational world we're going to is a team of teams. It is not a hierarchy. A hierarchy, a few people, everyone else doing repetitive functions, that can't work. When change is coming fast from every direction, you need everyone in the organization to be looking and saying, oh, I see a change over here. Let's pull the right people together and we're going to contribute to that. The hierarchy is dead. The team of teams means that everyone has to be a player. In this world, to be a player, you got to be a change maker. So these two social entrepreneurs are among 500 who are working on that, and there's an opportunity for all of us to contribute to this. Now, I'll come back to this theme, but there are many other types of fellows. The giant African rat is not a fellow, but is organized by a East African fellow. It turns out that the giant African rat is pretty smart and has extremely good smell and has the great advantage over dogs and people of being very light. So if you are in a minefield and the rat is trained to identify mines, the rat isn't blown up if it makes a false step. This is a big advantage. The rat also turns out to be very good at identifying TB from spit samples, and if you don't have a lab in a village, this is a very useful thing. Now, I could give you almost 3,000 examples. They have certain things in common. Each of these people gave themselves permission to cause a big change, to change the whole system, and they're doing it. Everyone here could have solved these problems. There is no rocket science in any of these answers, but they gave themselves permission. Well, this is a key part of the world we're trying to get to, and everyone a change-maker world. If you don't think of yourself as a change-maker, and you don't have the confidence you have those skills, why on earth would you see a problem? All you're going to do is feel badly about yourself. On the other hand, if you're a change-maker, you're always looking. Ah, this is an opportunity for me to express love and respect in action, which is what people really want to do. And you know you can do it, and other people know that they can do it. Now, that's a world where there is no way that the problems can outrun the solutions. That's the world we have to get to. Now, I want to give you, just because Ruth mentioned I was at McKinsey, I have to show you a chart. And so here it is, and it shows that after 5 years, 97% are continuing full-time. Some people get ill, some people go into government, but 88% are continuing, have had independent institutions copy, and over half have changed national policy within 5 years. So no one is making up. Social entrepreneurs are really, really powerful. And you can do this. You can do the same thing. Now, Ruth wasn't following her own rules. Okay. So, I'm glad we're showing that the bottom up is better than the top down here. All right, so now the basic building block are these amazing fellows. The second thing is you build them into a community. This is incredibly powerful. Iwan Nusarwin is an Indonesian Ashoka fellow. He figured out how you can create a whole new crop without land. This is a trick. What you do is you put mushroom seeds on soft wood chips and you float them on rice paddies. Well, you know, you could do this in a large part of the world, but he didn't want to be Johnny Mushroom Seed for the rest of his life. So he works with other fellows, and they like the idea of having new jobs that produce food that don't require land. There are many, many different ways individuals can work together. We also work together more broadly. I was talking with some of you outside about Pakistan. Well, Pakistan is a very dangerous place right now, and so we have a highly encrypted system that fellows can communicate with one another, how to work together. There are many other ways of collaborating. So 2.0 hugely magnifies the impact. But as I said earlier, the third level, which we've only really come to understand, is this collaborative entrepreneurship. Now, it's very hard for business entrepreneurs to do this because the game is capturing a market and digging a moat. Social entrepreneurs aren't in that game. Our game is how do you change the world? And the typical way a social entrepreneur does that is they make their idea really simple, understandable, safe, supported where necessary, so people all over can take their idea and run with it. The Canadian fellow, Mary Gordon, is not running thousands of schools. That would never happen. But she can get people in the Isle of Wight, believe it or not, and in Australia and Winnipeg to say, this is really important. I want the kids, including my kids, in this community to have this, and we're going to organize and make that happen. So there's a whole extra dimension of power to social entrepreneurs. They are recruiting thousands of local people to stand up and be change makers. That is part of the roots of an everyone a change maker world. Now, when we actually sit down and look at 500 fellows, you see patterns. That's actually pretty easy. And we thought that's what we had to do. We called it mosaic building. But it turns out that that's only an intermediate step, because the patterns you see are what's practical, feasible now. What you really have to do is see what the new paradigm is going to be, the new S-curve. But the patterns are very helpful in getting there. So I very intentionally exposed you to two fellows and told you about more dealing with young children. The old paradigm of growing up was learn knowledge and rules, and you'll be fine. Well, in the static world, that's probably true. But in the world we're in, let alone the world that a 15-year-old today will be in when she's 30, that is not fine. That is absolutely inadequate. We have to redefine success in growing up, and this is the new paradigm. By 21, you have to be practiced at being a change maker. You have to have mastered these skills the only way you can, which is by actually doing it. So you start in first grade, you grasp empathy, and then you practice it, you practice it, you practice it through group play and other things. From 12 through 20, you've got to be practicing empathy, teamwork, leadership, and change making, four complicated learned skills. You don't do that by reading a book. It's not simple. It's like learning language. And this is just like literacy. We're going to understand in 5 years that any young person who does not have these social skills is illiterate in this critical set of social skills, without which they are not going to be able to express love and respect in action, to be a contributor, to be team members. This is the worst thing you can do to anyone. Any society that doesn't change what we're doing with our children and young people right now is going to be a Detroit in 15 years. It won't take 50 years. If we don't have a population, if Poland or South Africa or India, any country doesn't have a population of change makers, it won't be able to function. It won't be able to compete in a world where success is defined by what proportion of the people are change makers, at what level, how well do they work together. If you're running a company, where are you going to get a workforce to be able to compete with the Poles if they have a population like this and we don't? This is very fundamental. If you're a parent, what would you do if your 15-year-old daughter was failing at math? Well, you know, you'd hire a tutor, because you don't know what to do about math. But you know that you have to do something and you have a list. Now, if I asked you, what would you do if she was not practicing change-making? Would you notice? Would you know what to do? It's actually pretty simple. You know, teenagers give themselves permission to see things that are messed up, and they tell you. So why don't you say, well, why don't you go and fix that stream? Or the way immigrant kids are being treated in school. Who, me? Yeah, why not you? And besides, this is really important. If you're going to grow up and be successful, this is a set of skills you've got to have. Any parent can do that. Anyone can do that for a young person they care about. And you can help change the schools and get the principal to focus on it. I mean, this is, I'm just giving you one example of the power. Once you see the new paradigm, we can't get to an everyone a change maker world as a society or a city or whatever if we don't do this. And then what do we, you know, we've got to make it clear what each person has to do. So that is what we are setting out to do, hopefully with your help. We want to make sure that 5 years from now, every principal does know that their children have to master empathy and that the teens have to be practicing it. Similarly, we have, you know, I could give you other examples about the law serving everyone, business and society working together in profoundly new ways. Each one of these, we have a collaborative entrepreneurship opportunity. So this is 3.0, it's extremely powerful. Now, what does all this mean for you? This is the last set of questions. I've already hinted at some of them. If you have a young person you care about, you have a new agenda as of tonight. If you care about an institution, ask yourself, is that institution making the transition to be a team of teams, or is it still a hierarchy? in every industry, there's going to be one company who figures out how to be a team of teams, and they are going to demolish the competition very fast. Well, if you're a leader of an institution, in other words, a company, a church, a citizen group, whatever, that's a strategic problem you have right now. And, you know, we as a society have an opportunity to help everyone see this change in the strategic environment, what it means for them. If you're a writer, if you lead an organization, it's very easy to do this, and it's really important. So we are at a moment of profound transition, and we need you. Thank you.
Bill, age before beauty. I'm going to let you stand up at the podium, and I'll stay down here. I want to thank Bill Drayton, extraordinary social entrepreneur and inspirational leader, for his comments. And now we have opened this up for questions. So, Bill, I have questions about Ashoka specifically and about social entrepreneurship as a field. So why don't we start with the field, and then we'll end up focusing on Ashoka. This field has taken off in terms of awareness, and you might even say it's reached the tipping point, or it's past the tipping point in terms of great public awareness. Would you say that it has?
In most of the world, yes. There are still a few isolated pockets, but yes.
What about in the United States?
It's uneven, depending on which parts of the United States you are. In San Francisco, it took off a long time ago. But we still have significant communities where there's a lot of work to be done.
And what are your suggestions about taking on that work in terms of increasing awareness about the concept which you need to have before you can actually start doing the tasks that you outlined at the end of your talk?
Well, if a child doesn't master empathy, you can forget the rest of it. Mm-hmm. And we have whole communities where that is not happening because the parents don't have the skill, the community doesn't have the skill, it's not part of the street culture, the schools don't realize that this is an issue. Now, in that picture, where are those children supposed to get that skill? How on earth can we imagine them being social entrepreneurs if they can't function in society? You can't do teamwork or leadership or change making if you don't have that basic skill. We have a large part of our population, a large part of the world's population, who don't have that skill. Now, how many middle and high schools in this country have a youth culture where it is normal for kids to take the initiative and set up organizations and solve problems? Most of our youth culture, the adults are in charge of everything, and please don't get in our way because we do it better, faster, and besides, we're rather nervous about you irresponsible people. Well, of course, you know, this is sort of like the end of the colonial era. You treat people that way. They don't like it. They're resentful. You have sort of a negative peer culture. And in fact, you don't have a culture. Now, if you go to the best elite high schools, I visited Phillips Academy Andover recently, there's a student organization for every 9 students, and the students are absolutely in charge. Well, guess what? The kids coming out of that school know that they have this skill, and they've been practicing it a lot. And the whole peer culture says yes, and the adults have gotten used to it and actually rather like it. Now, we've taken some high schools in this country. Leominster High School went from 0 student organizations to almost 40 in 4 years. This is not an elite high school. Just one person said, we don't want everyone moving out of this place, and if we can get people to be change makers, okay, they won't. They don't have to. And I think he's right. Now, we could do that anywhere, but we have to get 100,000 young Americans every year to do this. That's a big change. If we do that, those communities will change very quickly. If the kids are doing it, adults will learn. The best way for adults to get this is to have them understand that this is really important for their kids, and then all of a sudden they begin to realize that, oh, my God, these are the skills I better have, too. Companies can help with this. Think about your employees. Well, why not give a challenge to your employees? You nominate any young person that you know, in your family or not, and if they have a dream and are willing to build a team, we'll help with the seed money. This is what Ashoka's Youth Venture does. And we'll be happy to work with the company to do that. Well, that's a very powerful message to help the company begin to make the journey that it needs these skills. The parents help the kids. The parents learn as much as the kids. There are very simple things we can do, but if we don't do it, we're going to be a society more divided, and we may not make the cut in 15 years. I mean, it's just, when I'm more divided, let me explain what I mean. The level of these skills that you need every year is going up because of that exponential curve. And what was enough skill in 1960 isn't enough now. Now, if we've got 20, 25, 30% of our population that hasn't even started on empathy, they're getting further and further behind. The hole is getting deeper. This is a tragedy.
So one member of our audience wants to know, while that may be true, there are also communities, large communities around the world, that are becoming more narrow-minded due to religious differences, cultural differences, more fundamentalist in their approach to seeing the world. How does Ashoka deal with that also growing phenomenon?
Well, let me expand on that. We also have huge corruption problems and other symptoms of real social trouble. And I think this is simple. I mean, it's not simple. This is largely a function that we're going through a transition. The old structures are collapsing. The hierarchies can't work anymore. The old way we used to do things was rules and enforcement. Well, the world is too complicated. You can't enforce the rules, so everything's changing too fast. And so, of course, you get a lot of corruption. And people become very fearful in transitions. So I think social entrepreneurs, and everyone else, is the key issue here is how quickly and how intelligently can we get through this transition. Of course people are scared. If you don't have the skills to be a change maker, it's very hard for people who have this set of skills to imagine how scary the world looks as it changes faster and faster, and the things you thought you could count on, like jobs and the skills you have, the rules, they aren't there anymore. And this is terrifying. And if you can't give skills to your kids, so this is a very difficult transition. Fundamentalist reactions of all sorts are completely understandable, and they typically come from people who are more exposed to the change, not less. So very difficult transition, and this is exactly what we need entrepreneurs for.
Okay, let me just switch tacks a little bit. Within this field of social entrepreneurship, there's a lot of talk about the morphing between profitable enterprises and nonprofit enterprises, and the focus on the word entrepreneurship in terms of bringing business rigor into the equation. Some people have very strict definitions about this term, and others don't. Where do you see the field moving in terms of private sector initiative versus nonprofit, and what would be a good outcome there?
Well, first of all, the idea that business is doing better is highly suspect. We know, for example, that privately held companies consistently do better than publicly held companies, because they don't have the quarterly focus on finance-only measures. Do we really want to have quarterly measures and all those sorts of things? I don't think so. McKinsey, I like analysis. That's not the point. But there are a lot of things you need judgment for. And, you know, social entrepreneurs have a new idea. There's no comparison. How do you do comparative analysis for Mary Gordon when she's getting started? You have to use judgment, discipline judgment. And we're afraid of judgment. Bureaucracies can't do it. 24-year-old financial analysts don't do it. This is not a good model. Now, when you think about a team of teams, a global team of teams, having this division between business and society is incredibly destructive. It's a leftover from history. Business was the first everyone a change maker sector. Around 1700, it said, anyone with a better idea, if you implement it, we're going to make you really happy and we're going to copy you. And that set in motion the history of progress and change. And the social half of the world got stuck for 300 years for a variety of reasons. It remained small, fragmented, unproductive. And so you had these two worlds that didn't talk and they wear different clothing. They don't like one another. Well, this is incredibly stupid and destructive. So 1980, the citizen sector broke free from that and became entrepreneurial and competitive in exactly the same sense as business. People can enter. If you do better, you gain market share and resources and elan. And there has been an that's why we set up Ashoka in 1980, actually, because we saw that was the historical moment. And since then, there has been an explosive catch-up growth in productivity and scale and now globalization. And so you actually have two sectors that have the same architecture and have closed most of the productivity gap. And just one measure of that is that the citizen sector has employment growth at 2.5 to 3 times that of the rest of the OECD economies because we're catching up in productivity so much. Now, we have an incredible strategic opportunity to end the division. And one of the other areas of collaborative entrepreneurship that we've been working on for the last 4 or 5 years is to do precisely that. We have 500 of the fellows working on ensuring that every human being can be a full player in the economy. And one of the first things they figured out is tear down this barrier and create an entirely new production and distribution system that takes the best of the citizen sector and the best of the business sector. This is not moving a product to poor people through existing systems. This is completely changing the system. So to sell this, we figured we had to demonstrate it in 3 different industries on 4 continents, which we have now done in 6 of these cases. And I'll just give you one example. If you go to India, we started 14 months ago. India has a shortage of 24.7 million housing units for informal sector workers in the city, according to the government. That's before the 700 million that are about to come into the cities. Now, the current system didn't work for these people. Total market failure. Builders and developers and finance people couldn't deal with informal sector workers. Someone who sells vegetables, works every day, has income but no paperwork. And furthermore, these sort of elite people don't know these other people. There's probably class and caste differences and political uncertainties. So total failure of the market. Now, citizen sector in the last 10 years has come up and is very competent. You have big citizen groups who know how to deal with these people. They deal with them all the time. So, the citizen groups are not particularly good at building or finance, but they're really good at dealing with the market. So you put these together, and in 14 months, we have $120 million financed for over 15,000 new units for informal sector workers in the city. Now, if you divide 15,000 into 24.7 million, you can begin to imagine the size of the market failure that we're beginning to deal with. The exact same thing is happening in health and irrigation. The irrigation companies near here in Mexico, they don't serve small farmers, not profitable. Cut off is 10 to 55 hectares. Well, there's a huge part of the land area of Mexico that is smaller farms. Those companies can't sell to those markets. But if they did, the farmers would have 2-3 times the income, less uncertainty because they're not dependent on the rains. You'd be conserving water. This is a really big deal. So, again, market failure, but what's happened in the last 10 years? Citizen groups have come up all over rural Mexico, serving 50,000, 100,000, 200,000 small farmers. There's trust. Their cost structure is low. They understand the politics. You put these together, and all of a sudden, you can actually get drip irrigation to small farmers. We're talking about hundreds of millions of small farmers across the world. For those of you who are in finance, you start thinking about the size of the financing opportunities here. This is not a small deal. This is a fundamental pattern change. Our goal 5 years from now is that anyone who's thinking about strategy in any sector is going to ask, where is the business-social hybrid that we can build? That's one of the stock strategic questions. And they know the next five questions. Our strategy, which I'm inviting you to join, those of you who are in the management consulting and perhaps financial sectors, this is a whole new practice. Hystra is a French company that has just been founded to do this, hybrid strategies, and they're doing very well. They're going to be consultants busy for 60 years building hybrid value chains and improving them. So there's tremendous opportunity and tremendous need. But again, you have to break the frameworks of thinking, and that's what collaborative entrepreneurship does.
And can these hybrid models be profitable also as well? I mean, can they be for-profit companies? Or
they are highly profitable.
Okay.
Highly, highly, highly profitable. I mean, just take this, the first example, you know, the builders, developers, the finance companies are all making a lot of profit. They love this. The citizen groups are getting a 30-40% markup. Now, think about what that means for the citizen sector. You don't have to deal with the government or foundations anymore. You get to be independent in a couple of years if you do this. This is a really, I mean, very profitable. And we actually are very grateful to one of the Draper funds for being an investor in HealthPoint, which is the healthcare model.
Okay.
And I'm sure that they thought it was going to be profitable, which it will be.
Ashoka has an extraordinarily rigorous process for picking fellows. Now there's a lot of energy going to finding social entrepreneurs, and everyone wants to be a social entrepreneur. Maybe you could just talk to your experience with finding those people and what sets the ones you find apart from those that don't make it through your process.
All right, but now I asked everyone here to think about that. What were the common elements between the examples I gave? Well, first of all, they gave themselves permission. And then they persisted. It's very simple. Ultimately, that's the barrier. We're very clear about what we're looking for. We have a five-step process. There are different people at each step. The criteria are very simple. Creativity, entrepreneurial quality, which I'll come back to. Is the idea, separate from the person, sufficiently new, practical, attractive that people in the field will say, yeah, that's a good idea. I want to do this. I'm going to make this work. Does it have legs, and how important, how beneficial? And then finally, ethical fiber. So creativity is both goal setting and problem solving. It's pretty straightforward. You need both. Now, what do we mean by entrepreneurial quality? We do not mean getting things done, managing, leading. Millions of people can do that. The core to understanding an entrepreneur is that they are not going to be a happy human being. They can't stop until their idea has become the new pattern in society. They're married to the idea, and there's no negotiating about reaching that goal. Now, they don't know how to get there. They keep experimenting, learning, changing, but they're going to get there. And that means they're focused on the how-to questions as well as the goal. How am I going to solve this problem, seize that opportunity? How are the pieces going to fit together in 5-10 years? So it's a very understandable mindset. And, you know, we just ask questions, how-to questions. And the idealists, they can do is tell you what Xanadu looks like again, because they're not really into the how-to issues. But the entrepreneurs, when they get over the surprise that someone is asking them about this for the first time, because most people don't want to get into this, they take a deep breath and they're with you and it gets exciting. So that entrepreneurial quality is really important. That means that also they're very good listeners. They're not ideologues because they have to hear if something isn't working. They want to hear. That's part of the learning process. Now, ethical fiber, I want to add, this is very, very important. Entrepreneurs are always asking you to do things that are completely unreasonable because it's a new idea. You've never done it before. And how are you ever going to explain this to the boss and everyone around you? But people do it. And it's not the words. Words, I mean, if you say something really stupid, that hurts. But I think the basic transaction is when the entrepreneur walks into the room, people know this is a good person. They trust them. That's absolutely essential. And then they know that this person and this idea are married. They're one. Therefore, they can trust the idea. And that's the heart of the transaction. Any entrepreneur who is not a really good person, who is not seeking to express love and respect in action for the good of all, isn't going to succeed. And furthermore, we don't want them in our community.
So, Bill, Shoka started with a focus on social entrepreneurs in emerging or developing economies. And in more recent times, you've expanded your reach into Europe and the United States. Those characteristics that you just described are fundamental across everyone. But would you say that there's any differences in the skill sets between those that are working in developed countries versus developing?
I think the personality is the same. The tests are the same. And we apply exactly the same tests. We get exactly the same results. There are a few minor differences. The Middle East, you only have 29% have changed national policy within 5 years. But in general, it's very uniform across subject matter, time, and geography. So the core personality, the nature of the task is very similar. Now, there are adaptations, In Indonesia and Japan, there are issues of face that you have to deal with. Right. But those are adjectival. They're not unimportant, but they're adjectival more. And the differences are more likely to be in areas of family structure and than something like the environment. Now, global polls show that people all over the world basically have the same point of view about the environment. They're way ahead of the public officials. And, whether it's a small country in Africa or it's a big country in Asia, they all have the same point of view. But families are different. That's a much deeper set of patterns. But in general, no, I don't think there are big differences.
Okay. I just want to circle back to the private sector. There is now a fair amount of money, including Kleiner Perkins putting money into social investment vehicles, which focus on profitable endeavors in this space. It sounds like what you're saying is there's plenty of opportunity to make money and that these kinds of funds are going to proliferate. Is that right?
Well, I'd like to go a little bit further. I mean,
okay.
We have two financial systems, one that has its problems but is pretty efficient and very adaptive and very competitive. And then we have government grant agencies and foundations, which are the main institutional finance for the citizen sector. The chasm between these two financial systems is very unhelpful. McKinsey did a survey that was Stanford Innovation Review published about 4 years ago. Just the transaction costs of dealing with foundations and governments, 20 to 45%. Private financial, business financial institutions, 2 to 5%. And that's before you get to being willing to deal with long-term and so on. If you think about what a social entrepreneur needs and what these two sets of institutions institutionally are set up to do, there's an almost complete mismatch. The entrepreneur wants you to really like a new idea. Well, how does that fit into legislation and rules and regulations and branches and divisions and for foundation strategies? It doesn't. It's a huge pain in the neck for the program officer because they have to talk to five other people. They don't want to do that. It takes more time. There's nothing in it. I mean, it just that doesn't work. You have to build an institution. Well, causing change in a democratic society is not instantaneous. It's not a one-year affair. Well, that doesn't fit their time horizon. The entrepreneur wants you to be loyal to him or her because this is their life. It's not a one-year project. Well, these institutions don't do that. That's judgment. How would we deal with that? Building institution is overhead. So there's a complete serious structural problem here. Now, individuals try very hard to overcome this. There are some institutions that are close to their founders that do a really good job. But that's the exception, and it's not the structural problem. So I think we need to collapse these financial institutions. We actually have 6 projects designed to do that. One of them, which I invite everyone here to contribute to, is the Social Investment Entrepreneur Program. We're looking for people who are entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs in social finance. There's a wave that's coming. It's wonderful. So Felipe Vergara from Colombia, he looked at the education finance system in most of the world. It's one of the main causes of structural corruption. The government puts money in, it puts whatever it has in its budget, it has no market clearing mechanism to figure how much, let alone within which areas, so you have something that's hugely valuable and that they then underprice. Now, what on earth do you think that leads to? Well, the nice word is influence. The father of a very good friend in Mumbai founded 9 law colleges there. Every 5th or 6th dinner, someone comes by late in the dinner. Oh, you know my niece? Yeah, a very nice person. No, she's really smart, don't you think? Yes, don't you think she should be a lawyer? Oh, yes, why don't you have her come and see me? Well, that's nice influence. In Nigeria, it's just priced. It's very straightforward. all over the world, young people are entering their adult life in a corrupt system, and they know it. Everyone knows it. We don't have enough places. Now, so Felipe Vergara has found a very simple way. He's creating for-profit human capital funds, and you can invest in Peruvian undergraduates or a fund for disabled students going to college in Mexico. You don't know what anyone learns, but you do know what the group will learn. It's very, very safe. And now think where this is leading. You've done away with a capital shortage. You have a market clearing mechanism. If you invest too much in veterinary students, the returns will go down and Lipper will say bad fund. And you've cut away the legs of corruption. You've opened education. There's more to it. Now, I could give you many examples. We're just entering a wave of change in the financial system, which is part of tearing down the gap between business and society. And it's really important. San Francisco is a center of financial innovation. Here is a new opportunity. And, I love what Kleiner is doing and the others are doing. They're pushing the frontier. And I just caution that we need to have new financial systems all across the board, not just in the social enterprise area. That's a little caveat.
Okay, let's get to some specific questions about Ashoka. First, the name. Can you explain it?
Sure. If you're trying to create a global organization, you quickly discover there are some little problems. You can't use any language because every language belongs to one tribe or another, even English. You can't use a picture because that doesn't work very well on the phone. So you have a choice. You'd use the name of a person, or you make up something like Exxon or Kodak. And Landor Associates here, if you pay them $4 or $5 million, they'll come up with a name like that for you. So we chose the name of a person, being ignorant of all this at the time. And Landor actually did a pro bono work for us 5 or 6 years later, and they said, boy, you guys did a great job. It begins and ends in a vowel, 2 risers. It doesn't mean anything terrible in any language we can find, and it means something. So Ashoka lived in the 3rd century BC. He was the key transition figure in India between the city-state period and the first All India unit. And he was very tolerant. He was supportive of, we found records of over 350 different schools of thought. He He's very global-minded. He said, oh, well, this is sort of the values we're into, and very, very creative and social welfare, a whole series of things. And furthermore, he said, you know, he lived before Christianity and before Islam, so how many enemies could he possibly have?
Well, you'd be surprised, probably. Okay. Can you explain the Ashoka vision in terms of education? What are you looking for among social entrepreneurs to change within education? Obviously, the empathy piece is a big part of that. But as you go and interview social entrepreneurs, what are you really looking for within the field of education?
Just one small thing. We try to avoid the old words. So education is so tied to the existing institutions, ways of thinking, that we just don't use it. And if you want to break out of these frameworks, it's useful. So we talk about growing up. And so what are the most important things that children and young people have to do to grow up? And what I've been talking about during the session today, it's these social skills. Now, you do need to be literate in the old-fashioned sense, but if you know you're a change maker, you can learn anything. You can put people together in teams. This is incredibly powerful. Now, we know from interviewing many, many, many social entrepreneurs, the third step in our process is a 5 to 8 hour life history interview, which also explores the idea. And so we know the life histories. And almost every significant entrepreneur today started something in their teens. You try this among the friends you know. It's totally understandable. You know, once you know you have that skill, of course you're going to do it over and over again. You get better and better at it. And this is what society needs. I mean, just look at salaries. People who have these skills, the bidding for people with these skills is just going through the roof, because every institution, at least some level, knows they've got to be able to adapt to change, and they've got to have someone who can do this. And there isn't much of a market for people who don't have these skills. And it's just that's just going to get more and more. So I know this is single-minded of me, but I think this is one of those cases where a very simple idea is what's needed. And I loved Waiting for Superman. I love the thinking behind it. But most of this is an argument about how do we get the traditional education to everyone. Well, that's important. But if you don't get the new set of social skills, if the kids who are going to those better schools are not learning the social skills, they're going to have a big trouble by the time they're 30. And, you know, this is an opportunity to leapfrog ahead. It's 20 hours for Mary Gordon to help young children grasp empathy. And how expensive it is to encourage kids to set up a tutoring service. They do it. Their work. I mean, this is not exactly break the budget stuff. It's not threatening the unions. It's not threatening anyone. But it's a fundamental pattern change. And so, you know, entrepreneurs are about changing the system. Fundamentally. And you know, I didn't make this up. Mary Gordon did her piece. Jill did her piece. We just saw the patterns. And now we're able to help this group of people work together to flip the system. So what we need to do now, just to take this piece, we want 5% of the elementary, of the influential schools to do this. We want 30, 40 of the most influential mavens, writers, policy people, union leaders. Any of you who are a maven and like to do this, this is a huge opportunity to make a contribution. If you're writing about economics and you don't understand this, you've missed the boat. If you're a journalist trying to help people understand the world they're in and what they need to do and where the society has to go, this is a lens that you need. So our goal is to find the people who will model it and multiply it.
So Ashoka has been pushing the envelope since you created the organization. There's a number of very tech-savvy people in our audience, and they want to know how you're using technology to push the envelope, and what does that mean in terms of your work?
Well, first of all, you think about this world we're going into. It's a team of teams of people working together very flexibly or the pieces coming together. That's what the internet does. This community has made a huge contribution to building this new world. Silicon Valley is a team of teams. That is how it works. Bangalore is. The Jesuits have been for 450 years. There are islands, and the islands are getting better. This community is very important. Every time an institution here figures out how to do a better job of helping change makers be productive and work together, they're moving the competence of the island and the world ahead. So that's the first thing. I think this community is hugely important. You know, I can say to people in Japan, you know, I'm not making this up. Just look at Silicon Valley. That's how it works. And now the second thing is we obviously are hugely grateful more parochially because we work all over the world, and it's very, very helpful to be able to talk to people without it costing a fortune. Just simple stuff. Now, this collaborative entrepreneurship thing I was describing, you have an open source beginning. We elect fellows without any preconditions of subject matter. When you get a couple of hundred, you know it's ripe. So that's an open source. Then we go into an entrepreneurial process that's very focused. But in parallel to it, we have changemakers.org, .net, .com, anything else we could find. And it is an open source problem-solving, collaborative problem-solving process that links with the collaborative entrepreneurship work. So we think we have a principle that makes changemakers much richer. It starts with the best knowledge coming out of the entrepreneurial community. But then someone in Tibet or someone in the U.S. Army or whomever has something to contribute, they can. And eventually change makers is going to be much more than what it is at the moment. Anyone with a good idea comes. There's many ways that the idea gets better. There's a whole series of channels that moves it out. Change makers locally can come together. That's just one example. I'm embarrassed to tell you we have over 60 websites. Don't ask.
We have a number of questions that I don't have time to ask you tonight, so I hope that you'll be able to stay around for a few minutes after the program and let people come and ask you. It is clear to me, Bill, that throughout this whole discussion, what comes across loud and clear is your optimism about the world. And it's really quite refreshing because there's a lot of reasons to be worried about our world right now. Is that a fair assessment? Are you optimistic, and why is that?
Well, let me use a metaphor, and I apologize to any biologists in the room. If you think about the Everyone a Changemaker world and analogize each person to a really smart white blood cell, but as they live their life, whenever they see anything that's stuck, they not only go and destroy it, but they know how to make it better. And now that is a world where there's simply no way that the problems outrun the solutions. If everyone is able to do that, they're going to be happy, whole people, because what makes people happy is contributing. And we have this ballet of everyone with really strong empathetic skills moving quickly. This is a very exciting world. The transition's a bit tricky, but we'll get there.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much, Bill, for this amazing talk, for all your hard work and your game-changing efforts. I also want to point out that you've come to San Francisco at a very important time. And so on behalf of the Commonwealth Club, I need to present you with this souvenir, which we hope you'll wear wherever you go.
Thank you.
Today's program has been the sixth in the Commonwealth Club series on social entrepreneurship. I'm Dr. Ruth Shapiro, social entrepreneur in residence at the Commonwealth Club, and today's program at the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.
Great. Well, thank you.